This episode of Swindled may contain graphic descriptions or audio recordings of disturbing events which may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
Traders in Hong Kong were fearful from the start, and they were right. In the end, the Hang Seng Index fell almost 400 points. It was the worst close in 2 years. But investors may ignore financial instability in Asia at their peril.
It was the opportunity of a lifetime, Rob Kissel explained to his wife Nancy. Goldman Sachs, the global investment banking firm, had offered him a promotion, managing director of its Asian Special Situations Group. Just 34 years old, Rob had already established himself as one of the best in the world at managing distressed debt, and now he was being rewarded for it. The timing couldn't have been better. It was the summer of 1997, and Southeast Asia was on the brink of a financial crisis. Currencies would collapse and banks would fail. Across the continent, trillions of dollars worth of loans and bonds tied to struggling companies would soon be up for grabs for pennies on the dollar, if and when those companies recovered. Investors like Rob Kissel at Goldman Sachs stood to reap extraordinary gains. What does that mean? Nancy asked. Money, honey, Rob said. So much money. Hundreds of thousands in salary, millions in bonuses, the kind of wealth most people can only fantasize about. Nancy's ears perked up. Oh, but there is one more thing, Rob added. We have to move to Hong Kong. Hong Kong? Nancy hesitated. It was half a world away from the comfortable life they had built in New York City. They had two young children, a beautiful apartment, wonderful friends. Was it really worth uprooting everything? Rob had already decided it was. His entire life had been leading up to this moment, and there was no way he was turning it down. Besides, he assured his wife, their lifestyle wouldn't be all that different. Goldman Sachs offered to pay the $20,000 a month rent on a luxury apartment at Parkview, a brand new residential complex that catered almost exclusively to wealthy expatriates just like them. It overlooked a 3,000-acre park and basically functioned as a self-contained city with supermarkets, restaurants, shops, tennis courts, Roman baths, everything.
Whether business brings you to Hong Kong for just 1 month, or your new job means you'll be here for a couple of years, Hong Kong Parkview can be your home away from home.
It wasn't exactly the life Nancy Ann Keeshan had envisioned for herself when that handsome fellow New Yorker sauntered up to her on a nude beach in Turks and Caicos a decade earlier and commented, "I bet you'd look great with your clothes on." It was a compliment, Rob promised. Nancy laughed, because the line worked, and he was right. Soon after, Nancy Kissel had given up her own dreams and dropped out of art school to work multiple restaurant jobs to support Rob while he obtained his MBA. She had traded her rowdy, hard-partying lifestyle for marriage and motherhood. Hong Kong, she supposed, was just another temporary sacrifice for the good of the family. And besides, as Rob promised, it would only be for a few years. However, a few years turned into a few more after Merrill Lynch lured 37-year-old hotshot Rob Kissel away from the competition. Nancy was less than thrilled. Not even the larger salary and the bigger apartment that came with the promotion were enough to cure her homesickness. How about a $2 million vacation home in our favorite ski resort town of Stratton, Vermont? Rob offered. Would that convince you to stay? Only if you include another $1 million in the budget for renovations, Nancy countered. Deal. Hong Kong would remain the Kissel's home for the foreseeable future. Nancy tried to make the best of it. Of course, having two live-in nannies certainly helped. She filled her days volunteering at the children's private school and United Jewish congregation. But her favorite pastime, by far, was shopping. While Rob worked up to 16 hours, sometimes in a far-off land, Nancy would spend entire afternoons roaming Hong Kong's luxury boutiques. Oftentimes, she would return home to unload her goods and take a quick nap before heading out for round two. Nancy's unrestrained spending had become a recurring source of friction in the Kissel's marriage, and the more Rob complained, the harder Nancy swiped her card. She had started to resent her physically and emotionally absent husband. "Go ahead, pour yourself another drink, Mr. 5-Minute Father," she would mutter under her breath. "Fly home from another business trip, bark your orders, and then fuck off again. Why don't you?" Nancy Kissel found herself resenting her children too, especially after giving birth to their third in the fall of 1999. She no longer felt beautiful, and Rob did little to reassure her. After a decade of marriage, it was clear that something inside of Nancy was shifting, and with each passing Chinese New Year, it became more difficult to suppress. Yet from the outside, people marveled at the Kissel facade. "We all envy you," a neighbor reportedly told her. "You two have the best marriage in Hong Kong." All the while, behind closed doors, Nancy recoiled from Rob's touch. Honestly, she began to cherish every second her husband was gone, and she found herself longing for more of them. But establishing such distance would require an act of God, or worse. Maybe a once-in-a-lifetime flood would keep Rob stranded in Malaysia for a few days longer. Perhaps the market would crash again and preoccupy all of his time. Or maybe, just maybe, a cave-dwelling horseshoe bat would infect a wild forest-dwelling mammal, like an Asian palm civet, for example, which would then wind up trapped and sold in a live animal market in some place such as Guangdong Province, where it would transmit a novel coronavirus to the people who came in contact with it, ultimately sparking a global epidemic, which would allow Nancy and the children to retreat to the States for safety while Rob stayed behind for work. Maybe Nancy had too much time on her hands to entertain such thoughts. Maybe not.
Air travelers arrive at O'Hare from Hong Kong today, many wearing masks. Airport workers playing it safe too, worried about the SARS scare hitting the Pacific Rim. SARS, which stands for Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome, highly contagious, with Asia the high-risk area.
During the final week of March 2003, Nancy Kissel, her three children, and one of the family's nannies boarded a flight to New York City. After schools refused to admit children arriving from SARS-stricken Hong Kong, they drove to the family's vacation home in Stratton, Vermont. Rob remained in East Asia for the time being, but much to Nancy's disappointment, he would join them a few weeks later. When he arrived, Nancy was colder than ever. She insisted he sleep in the basement and never even acknowledged his 40th birthday. Nancy didn't even hug him goodbye when he left for the airport. Rob wasn't so aloof that he didn't recognize that his marriage was failing, but he couldn't understand why. That summer, desperate for insight, he secretly installed spyware and a keystroke logger on Nancy's laptop. Within days, he uncovered near daily email exchanges with a man named Michael Del Priore. Del Priore, really? Rob recognized the name. He was one of the brothers who worked for Prime Focus Communications, the contractor that had installed the audio and video systems at the Vermont property. The emails he captured contained no explicit evidence of an affair, but they did little to ease Rob's suspicions. He wanted answers, so he hired Alpha Group, a New York private investigation firm run by retired NYPD detective Frank Shea. Over the following months, Rob paid Shea roughly $25,000 to conduct multiple surveillance operations, hoping to learn exactly who was coming and going from the Vermont house while Nancy was there.
Rob Kissel first approached me June of 2003. He wanted the confirmation. He was pretty convinced it was going on, but he wanted the evidence.
Within days, Alpha Group delivered its report. On multiple nights, usually between 9 and 10 p.m., a blue Chevy van would pull onto the street and park a short distance from the Kissel residence. Hours later, the same van would sputter away with its headlights off. It was too dark for the PI to identify the driver, but he did manage to record the license plate. The van was registered in New Hampshire to a 39-year-old man named Michael Del Priore, who lived in a mobile home just across the state lines. Rob Kissel was furious. Here he was working around the clock, trying to close one of the largest distressed debt deals ever, and his wife was back in the U.S. screwing around on him with trailer trash while the kids were in the house. Unbelievable. Rob called Nancy's friend, Bryna O'Shea, someone he had often confided in about their marriage. You're not going to believe this, he told her. I think Nancy's fucking the stereo boy. Rob admitted he'd come to that conclusion by reading her emails and staking out the vacation home. Why not confront her? Bryna asked. I can't. Not yet, at least. Rob said he still loved Nancy, and confronting her meant admitting he had been spying on her. Besides, all he had was circumstantial evidence. What if he was wrong? He wasn't. Not only was Nancy Kissel, quote-unquote, fucking the stereo boy, she had fallen head over heels in love with him. It had started innocently enough after Michael installed the Kissel family's home entertainment system that spring. Nancy had resorted to unplugging random wires behind the TV and calling Michael over to troubleshoot it. Those service calls became flirty conversations. Those conversations turned into off-the-clock hangouts and playdates for the kids. Before long, something deeper and physical had developed. Nancy felt like Mike saw her, like really saw her. Not just where she lived or what she drove or the diamonds on her wrist, but her, a real imperfect human being. And Michael, unlike her husband, accepted it. And he listened, like actually fucking listened. And as a recently divorced single parent himself, he could relate to Nancy's traumas and insecurities and desires. They grew closer and closer with each multi-hour phone call. And believe it or not, Southeast Asian distress debt never once came up in conversation. Nancy became convinced that Michael Del Priore was her soulmate. But alas, it was not meant to be. Rob Kissel did eventually confront his wife about spending time with another man and summoned her back to Hong Kong immediately. Nancy complied, expressed regret, but insisted and lied that the relationship with the stereo man had been entirely innocent. Still, she promised to cut off all contact with Michael Del Priore. Rob believed her, and just like that, everything was back to normal. Actually, it was better than normal. Like a weird dream, Rob later wrote in his journal. Nancy initiated affection again. She bought him gifts. She slept facing him instead of turning away. It was an intimacy he hadn't felt in years. But, Rob wrote, the real sadness and emptiness is that I love her, but may never trust her again. But Nancy Kissel was determined to earn back her husband's trust. That August, she even voluntarily, no, adamantly, accompanied Rob to New York for a surgery to repair a herniated disc he had suffered playing tennis earlier that summer. Unbeknownst to Rob, however, while he was lying in a hospital bed rehabbing his back, his newly attentive wife was reportedly getting hers blown out in the hotel stairwell just blocks away. At Nancy's request and expense, Michael Del Priore had made the trip from New Hampshire to reunite with his lover. She used prepaid calling cards to phone him every time Rob dozed off, and even carved out time to share a romantic horse and carriage ride with Michael through Central Park. When both of the Kissels got back on their feet, the couple returned to their perfect life in Hong Kong, but the illusion didn't last long. One afternoon, Nancy left her purse on the kitchen counter. Inside, Rob found monthly statements for a secret cell phone, mailed not to their apartment, but to the children's private school where Nancy volunteered. The records showed more than 100 calls to Michael Del Priore during the very months she pretended to fall back in love with their husband. This prompted Rob to reopen the spyware on Nancy's computer. He learned that she was sending Del Priore money and buying him stuff. He found out about their past day trips in Vermont, their rendezvous in New York, and a future trip planned for San Francisco. He discovered that Michael often referred to Nancy as baby doll, and that he was the one who had taken her to get that godforsaken tattoo on her shoulder. But instead of getting angry again, Rob Kissel just felt helpless and defeated. She was gone. Divorce was a foregone conclusion. Rob's only fear at this point was that Nancy would go back to the U.S. and take the children, and he was willing to do anything to prevent that. He would even move out of their apartment and pay to relocate Michael Del Priore to Hong Kong, if it meant, at the very least, preserving weekends with his kids. Rob shared these plans with his friends, colleagues, and private detective, Frank Shea, who had traveled to Hong Kong on unrelated business. Rob also divulged another disturbing development to Mr. Shea, when they met for dinner. He said the keylogger he had installed had revealed Nancy's recent internet search history. Oh yeah? And? Well, she had typed in the phrases sleeping pills, drug overdose, and medication causing heart attack. And even more concerning, Rob added, the bottle of scotch that he kept in the living room, the one he would routinely pour a glass from after a long, grueling day at work. It started to taste a bit funny, he told Frank, and it's been making him feel strange and woozy. Not like drunk, strange and woozy, more like drugged and sleepy. You don't think Nancy is trying to kill me, do you, Frank? Yes, Frank replied. I think I do.
I sat down with Rob Kissel and I looked him right across the table at the China Club and I said, Rob, I think Nancy's trying to kill you. He took in my statement. He didn't say that he bought it 100%, but he really was concerned about his safety. He even said that he would probably think about moving out until this was cleared up. And once again, I said, Rob, I said, let's go get tested now. Let's get this test over with.
Frank Shea urged Rob to have his hair and urine tested to find out whether he was actively being dosed with something. Rob promised he'd get around to it, but there were more pressing issues. First and foremost, he needed a lawyer. Rob had decided that he would inform Nancy that he was divorcing her the weekend after Halloween. Smart move, Mr. Kissel. Let us know how it goes.
Your call has been forwarded to an automatic voice message system. At the tone, please record your message. When you have finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
Bryna, it's Nancy. You've got to call me. It's very important. I just called my dad and he's flying down here. Rob and I had a fight. He chased me around the room. He wanted to have sex. He beat me up. Call me, please. That's the voicemail that the Kissel's close friend and confidant, Bryna O'Shea, woke up to on Sunday, November 2nd, 2003. It was 8 a.m. in San Francisco. She immediately called the number back. Nancy answered and elaborated. He beat the shit out of me and was chasing me around the bedroom demanding sex. It was terrible. He was drunk. I tried to fight him off, but he kept punching me and kicking me. He wouldn't stop beating me. I've got 2 broken ribs. I'm going to the doctor. I'm going to get this documented. Where is Rob now? Bryna asked. I don't know, Nancy replied, seemingly unbothered. He just ran out of the apartment. He probably flew to New York. Well, I'm happy to hear your dad is on the way, Bryna said. Take care of yourself, and I'll reschedule that breast lift you were planning to travel here for in a few weeks. Wait, what? Why? No, don't do that, Nancy pleaded. I'll be there. Considering the circumstances, Bryna found her friend's behavior and tone rather odd. She tried reaching out to Rob for his side of the story. Days passed without a response. Finally, she got through to Rob's friend and work colleague, David Ngo, who confirmed that Rob had not shown up to work all week. He had even missed an extraordinarily important conference call that Sunday night. The last time I talked to him was earlier that day, Ngo said. He sounded really messed up. He was slurring his words. He wasn't making sense. Ngo said he called Nancy on Monday, and she told him that Rob was busy resolving family issues, whatever that meant. She told me he probably went to New York, Bryna shared. Well, there's no way he's in New York, Ngo replied matter-of-factly. His passport is sitting in his desk drawer at the office. By then, everyone at Merrill Lynch was worried. They checked every hotel in the region. There was no trace of Rob Kissel. If nobody hears from him by tomorrow morning, Ngo decided, we're going to the police. But before the night was over, the urgency increased. One of the Kissels' live-in housekeepers, Connie, contacted Bryna, who immediately put her in touch with David Ngo. Something wasn't right inside the apartment, Connie relayed. Nancy had locked herself in the master bedroom for days, emerging only briefly to ask for cleaning supplies or to shop for new rugs and bedroom furniture. And then, just yesterday, Connie added, Nancy had dragged a rolled-up, misshapen carpet into the living room. Building staff was coming to move it into the basement storage soon, Nancy had told her. When the workers arrived, one of them nearly vomited because the carpet smelled like rotting fish. But what really set off alarms for Connie, she told Ngo, was Mr. Kissel's watch. It was still sitting on the counter, and he would never leave home without it. After ending the call with the housekeeper, David Noh went straight to the Hong Kong police. At 10:50 p.m. on November 6th, officers arrived at the Kissel's apartment in Parkview. They knocked on the door. Nancy answered. After some brief questioning, the detectives demanded to be taken to the storage room.
As soon as they opened the door, the smell was so overwhelming they knew straight away there was a dead body in there.
In the center of the storage lay the rolled up carpet. Four sofa cushions had been tied around the outside. The entire bundle was wrapped in layers of polyethylene sheeting. Black garbage bags covered each end and were sealed tightly with strips of adhesive tape. A crime scene investigator knelt beside it. He sliced through one end and slowly reached a gloved hand inside. He paused. Then he looked up at the other officers and nodded. "I can feel a human head." Investigators carefully peeled away the remaining layers until they reached a children's sleeping bag. Inside of that, wrapped in towels, was a man's body. Judging by what the housekeepers had described as his usual bedtime clothing, it was almost certainly Rob Kissel, but his face was barely recognizable. The right side of his head had been completely bashed in by something heavy, to the point where there was, quote, massive spillage of brain substance.
A senior executive of Merrill Lynch has been found dead in his apartment house in Hong Kong. He is 40-year-old Robert Kissel.
Robert Kissel, the successful banker in Hong Kong, discovered his wife having an affair with a TV repairman. This private investigator says Robert Kissel told him he thought she was trying to kill him.
The autopsy revealed that Rob Kissel had been dead for up to 4 days before his body was discovered. Toxicology tests found 5 different sedatives and antidepressants in his stomach and liver. 4 of them had been prescribed to Nancy Kissel in the weeks leading up to his death, including Stilnox, also known as Ambien in the United States, and Rohypnol, commonly referred to as the date rape drug. Blood spatter analysis gave further credence to an emerging theory. Rob was most likely lying down, head turned to one side, unconscious and completely defenseless, when someone repeatedly struck him with a heavy object. That heavy object was most likely the 8-pound metal and lead garden statuette depicting 2 young girls kneeling. It was a cherished family heirloom, and it was found detached from its base and coated in dried blood and Nancy's fingerprints at the bottom of a cardboard box in the basement. After the discovery of Rob's body, Nancy Kissel said nothing. She showed very little emotion as police took her into custody. Described by some observers as almost catatonic, she was transported to a psychiatric facility where she remained until legal proceedings began.
Prosecutors said the death of Robert Kissel in 2003 was a carefully planned then concealed murder. He was subdued by 6 drugs mixed in a milkshake, then beaten with a metal ornament.
What followed was arguably Hong Kong's trial of the century. Wealthy white foreigners, sex, violence, drugs, and unimaginable sums of money. A real-life soap opera, tailor-made for the tabloids. Prosecutors alleged that Nancy Kissel, driven by greed and an extramarital affair, had spent weeks trying to quietly poison her husband of 14 years with a cocktail of prescription drugs, hoping his death would appear natural. When that plan failed to materialize, Nancy grew impatient because she was racing against the clock of an impending divorce. On November 2nd, 2003, prosecutors said Nancy blended a sedative-laced milkshake and had one of their young daughters deliver it to Rob. Once he was unconscious, she picked up the heaviest object within arm's reach and bludgeoned him to death in their marital bedroom. Her alleged motive? An estate worth up to $20 million, and freedom to be with the man she truly loved without all the messy legal entanglements. On the stand, Nancy made a shocking admission. Yes, she had, in fact, killed her husband. But it was self-defense. Rob, she testified, was a controlling, paranoid, manipulative man who had subjected her to years of physical and sexual abuse during alcohol and cocaine-fueled rages. After Rob told her he was divorcing her and taking the children, Nancy said he was standing in the doorway with a baseball bat demanding one last inning. When she refused, Nancy claimed he attacked her. So in a desperate attempt to free herself, she grabbed the nearby statuette and started swinging it wildly until she made contact. And that's pretty much the last thing she could recall. Nancy says she didn't remember crushing Rob's skull with four additional fatal blows. She didn't remember wrapping his body in a rug, sealing it shut, and then leaving the apartment to shop for a replacement. She didn't remember communicating with her friend Bryna or Rob's workplace the following morning. She didn't remember the 3,000 minutes of conversation with Michael Del Priore leading up to the incident or the dozens of phone calls after. She didn't remember going to the police station with her father and giving investigators a completely different version of events than the one she told on the witness stand. She didn't remember calling an international moving company for an estimate to ship boxes back to the States. You weren't planning to use that butcher's saw hidden in your four-year-old son's closet to dismember your husband's body and ship him across the Pacific. Where are you, Nance? She didn't remember. In fact, Nancy claimed what bits and pieces she did recall from that night didn't resurface in her memory until roughly 6 months into her stay at the psychiatric hospital. This was proof, her defense team argued, that Mrs. Kissel had clearly suffered a psychological collapse of some kind in the aftermath of a desperate act of self-preservation. And all of her bizarre, irrational, sloppy, and unremembered actions that followed actually proved the killing wasn't premeditated. But to the people who actually knew Rob Kissel, his friends, his housekeepers, his co-workers, his family, many of whom testified, Nancy's story was preposterous. By all accounts, Rob was a mild-mannered family man who was not only fundamentally nonviolent, but the experts had already established that he was completely incapacitated at the time. Furthermore, Nancy's own doctors could not corroborate her accounts of years of physical and sexual abuse. And there was a simple reason for that, the prosecution argued. Because it simply never happened. They were slanderous lies. The jury didn't buy it either. After an 86-day trial, Nancy Kissel was unanimously convicted of murder, for which she was given the mandatory sentence in Hong Kong of life in prison. Michael Del Priore was never implicated or charged with any crimes. After the verdict was read, Rob's 78-year-old father, Bill Kissel, who had attended virtually every day of the trial, spoke briefly with reporters. He was pleased with the outcome. And his hope, he said, was that his son's name and reputation could finally be restored.
And justice has been done. Nancy has been declared guilty in a half a day by the entire jury. And I pray that Robert, the allegations made against Robert, the false allegations made against him, will now be forgotten. And Robert can rest in peace, and his children can now go on with their lives and have a wonderful life ahead, knowing that all these terrible things are untrue. And Robert was a beautiful, beautiful man and a beautiful, beautiful father. And he tried to be a good husband, but I'm glad it's over.
I hate to break it to you, Bill, but it's not over. In fact, we are just getting started. The brother of a slain investment banker forges a much different path to extraordinary wealth, only to arrive at an eerily similar but far more shameful fate on this episode of Swindled.
They bribed government officials,
accounting clear violations of federal and state law,
pay to play millions of taxpayer dollars that were wasted,
paid tens of millions of dollars,
$1 billion.
By falsifying its books and records,
responsible for the collapse of the entire system.
In the thrall of some kind of swindler.
Support for Swindled comes from Home Chef. I have a bad habit of working straight through dinner. I'll look up from the computer, realize it's almost 7 or 8 o'clock, and then face the same question every night. Do I cook something, order takeout again, or just eat peanut butter out of the jar over the sink? Lately, Home Chef has made that decision a whole lot easier. I've been getting a mix of their oven-ready meals and their quick 30-minute recipes, and they've all been ridiculously simple. Everything shows up pre-portioned, so I'm not standing in the kitchen trying to decipher some recipe that assumes I have 17 spices and unlimited patience. The meals actually taste like something I'd order at a restaurant, but without paying restaurant prices. And since they're built around lean proteins and fiber-rich, carb-conscious ingredients, I don't immediately regret what I just ate. The convenience is probably my favorite part. No grocery store, no meal planning, and almost no cleanup. Home Chef has more than 30 meal options every week, including calorie-conscious and GLP-1 friendly meals that are dietitian-approved. It's also rated number one by users of other meal kits for quality, convenience, value, taste, and recipe ease. Plus, Home Chef customers save an average of $86 a month on groceries. For a limited time, Home Chef is offering my listeners 50% off and free shipping for your first box, plus free dessert for life. Go to homechef.com/swindled. That's homechef.com/swindled for 50% off your first box and free dessert for life. homechef.com/swindled. Must be an active subscriber to receive free dessert. Support for Swindled comes from Blue Land. I try to be mindful about what I bring into my home, including the cleaning products I use every day. It's easy to focus on whether something works, but I've also started paying more attention to what's actually in the products I'm using. That's why I've been using Blue Land laundry tablets. The tablets use a microplastic-free formula with plant and mineral-based cleaning ingredients. They're hypoallergenic and safe for sensitive skin, and they're incredibly convenient. Just drop a pre-measured tablet directly into the washing machine and let it do the rest. No messy measuring, no bulky detergent jug, and they still handle everything from food stains to grass stains. Plus, using tablets instead of buying another plastic bottle every time is an easy way to cut down on single-use plastic at home. Blue Land is trusted in over 1 million homes, including mine. Blue Land is a certified B Corp and Leaping Bunny cruelty-free certified. Their formulas are EPA Safer Choice certified, and many products have also earned Cradle to Cradle's Gold Material Health Certificate. Make the switch today. Get 15% off your first order by going to blueland.com/swindled.
There we are. If the American success story had a name, it would be ours. The Kissels. We had it all. Private schools, thoroughbred horses, yachts, matching Porsches. You name it, we owned it. My brother and I have lives most people only read about. There I am. That's me. Andrew Kissel. One of Greenwich's elite.
Bill Kissel once described his son Robert as, quote, the man I would have liked to have been. And it wasn't hard to see why. Rob was a naturally gifted athlete and scholar with chiseled good looks and effortless charm that made him universally appealing. He breezed through life, making success look easy. Whenever Rob set his mind to something, he would simply excel at the highest level, and nobody was ever surprised. The oldest son, Andrew Kissel, on the other hand, was, in his father's words, a very different cat. He was quieter, more reserved, harder to read. An enigma, Bill called him. And again, it wasn't hard to see why. From an early age, Andrew understood and was constantly reminded that he would never measure up to his father, the self-made millionaire who built a fortune in the 1970s, manufacturing replacement toner cartridges just as photocopier technology was becoming widely adopted. Nor would Andrew ever be able to compete with Rob, the adulated younger brother, who was clearly more talented, smarter, better looking, and more fun to be around. Though overshadowed, Andrew did possess talents of his own. He was intelligent, entrepreneurial, and had a decent eye for design, but he had little interest in formal education. He did eventually enroll at Boston University a few years after high school, but primarily to distance himself from the 7,500-square-foot mansion in Saddle River, New Jersey, where he had grown up, because it was still occupied by his asshole father. After leaving, Andrew never once called home. Reportedly, Bill had to eventually hire a private investigator to track down his oldest son. This entire period of Andrew Kissel's life, including his early professional career, remains a mystery to everyone but him. As a result, as we go along, you'll probably notice there's very little video or audio of Andrew as a young adult. Even that clip you heard earlier,
that's me, Andrew Kissel,
wasn't the real Andrew Kissel. It was actually celebrated television actor John Uncle Jesse Stamos, portraying a considerably more handsome and undoubtedly fantastic-smelling version of Andrew for the Lifetime made-for-TV movie, The Two Mr. Kissels. We'll have to rely on Mr. Stamos's understated yet earnest performance to help fill some of these gaps, if you don't mind. Speaking of TV heartthrobs, Andrew Kissel actually married one, relatively speaking. His sister Jane introduced him to her world-class ski coach during one of the Kissel family's regular vacations in Stratton, Vermont. Her name was Haley Wolf. Off the slopes, she was an Ivy League-educated stock analyst, specializing in the leisure and toy industries. As her career took off, Haley became a familiar face on CNBC and CNN, where she frequently appeared on behalf of Merrill Lynch and later Smith Barney to discuss the market's ups and downs.
Joining us now from Stamford, Connecticut is Haley Wolf of Rockdale Securities. She follows the ski industry.
They've gotten distracted over the past 2 years by the lure of quick money.
Haley Wolf also happened to be the daughter of the CEO of a $500 million engineering firm in New Jersey. Andrew was 32 years old when he married her in 1992, and it was probably the first and only time his dad had ever been proud of him, especially compared to the woman the golden Kissel boy had brought home a few years earlier. A waitress, Rob? Really? Let's just hope she can at least make a decent milkshake. Time would tell. Like Rob and Nancy, Andrew and Haley Kissel settled in New York City and purchased a modest one-bedroom apartment on the 10th floor of 200 East 74th Street for $295,000. Everything seemed to be falling into place for the newlyweds to become Manhattan's next power couple. Everything except Andrew, who at the time was still underachieving at a low-level real estate job. But he had a vision. Hey, thanks for meeting me here, Rob. Damn, you're looking fit, little bro. Did you lose some weight? Alright, so hear me out. Andrew launched into his pitch. There are so many incredible investment opportunities to be found outside the city. So much undervalued real estate in the up-and-coming neighborhoods like Hoboken, Jersey City. How much do you need, Andy? Come on, Rob, let me finish, would you? Also, didn't I tell you to stop calling me that? I'm Andrew now, goddammit. Andrew. Anyway, I'm putting together an investment group. Because what I want to do is buy up some of these smaller apartment buildings and just sit on them, you know? We'll collect the rents and distribute the profits to everyone who owns a stake, and then eventually flip the buildings years down the road for a fat payday when they inevitably appreciate, you see? Yep. How much do you need? Well, I was hoping you'd be in for at least $500K. Okay, I'll see what I can do, but let me sleep on it, and I'll get back to you next week. But thanks for the opportunity, Andrew. Wait. Which name should I make the check out to if I decide to do this? Neither, actually. Make it out to Hanrock Group, LLC. Hanrock? Yeah. What is that? What does that mean? Well, I'm glad you asked. Hanrock is my new real estate management company. It's actually an acronym. You ready for this? H is for Haley, my lovely wife right over there. A is for Andrew, not Andy. That's me. N is for Nancy, your better half. And R is for Rob, my beautiful, talented, and generous baby brother.
I think that went very well. What do you think?
I think your brother married a bitch.
No, I'm talking about Hanrock. I think Rob's going to go for it.
Not only did Rob Kissel go for it, but by the end of 1994, Andrew had also convinced their father and a growing circle of friends, relatives, and acquaintances to invest what ultimately amounted to tens of millions of dollars in his real estate ventures. Even several of Andrew's neighbors in his apartment building got in on the action. Why wouldn't they? It sounded like a can't-lose proposition. Plus, Andrew Kissel was a trustworthy fellow. Earlier that year, he had been elected treasurer of the building's co-op board, which is basically the New York equivalent of a homeowners association. The co-op's board of directors was relieved that such a competent, big-time real estate professional like Andrew Kissel was willing to take on the thankless, unpaid volunteer role. Andrew was more than happy to do it. He loved the building, he loved the neighborhood, he loved the people. And over the next few years, he demonstrated his commitment to all of them by purchasing the units adjacent to his and Haley's one-bedroom apartment and combining all three into the building's crown jewel. They needed the extra space, Andrew explained to his neighbors. They had a young daughter and another one on the way. Oh, congratulations, Mr. Kissel. But not everyone at 200 East 74th Street was taken in by Andrew Kissel's charm. Michael Asael, a real estate attorney, CPA, and longtime resident of the building, thought Andrew was a blowhard. He had been suspicious of the new treasurer ever since Andrew tried to sublet his parking space through unofficial channels. For me, it's as if he had a neon sign on him that just said, "Phony," Asael later told the Greenwich Time. If Andrew was willing to bend the rules over something as trivial as a parking spot, what corners might the treasurer cut when millions of dollars were involved? It wouldn't take long to find out. Within a few years of Andrew becoming treasurer, routine repairs and maintenance at the building had slowed to a crawl. Yet according to the co-op's financial statements, renovation costs had exploded from just $47,000 to nearly $1.4 million. An almost 30-fold increase. It was absurd, Asael said. Having served on the co-op board for years, the veteran CPA knew what these projects should have cost. Asael asked to rejoin the board in late 2002 so he could examine the books himself. Once reinstated, he wasted no time digging through the records. What he found was an astonishing number of discrepancies and accounting irregularities. Even worse, the co-op's internal financial controls were practically non-existent. Every invoice and bank statement had been mailed directly to Andrew Kissel and Andrew Kissel alone. He was also the only board member authorized to approve checks. Even then, Andrew often bypassed the paper trail altogether, opting to pay contractors by wire transfer instead. Any one of those practices would have been a red flag. Together, they did not paint a pretty picture, which is how Michael Asael described the situation in an email to the other members of the co-op board on December 6, 2002. And now that he had had a first-hand look, Asael believed wholeheartedly that something nefarious was being deliberately concealed. But more definitive proof was required to take action. So, in the early months of 2003, the co-op board's recently reformed finance committee began demanding answers from Treasurer Andrew Kissel. They requested detailed records of every capital improvement, copies of invoices, bank records, everything necessary to conduct what was essentially a full-scale audit. Kissel obstructed them at every turn. He produced incomplete records, claimed key documents were locked away in storage, and even submitted what appeared to be fabricated paperwork bearing stolen accountant's letterhead in an apparent attempt to throw investigators off his trail. It didn't work. "I can't believe I'm getting fried after 5 fucking years, Andrew exploded during a board meeting where he was accused of diverting at least $1 million from the co-op to himself. "I think I need some Valium," he announced before walking out. On March 11, 2003, the finance committee mailed a letter to every owner in the building detailing the financial misdeeds they had uncovered. The board announced that an independent forensic accountant would be brought in to determine exactly how much money had actually disappeared, because the records Mr. Kissel had provided simply could not be trusted. Andrew Kissel resigned as co-op treasurer by email the following day. By then, no one had seen him in the building for weeks. Security footage later showed him sneaking into the service elevator, exiting through the garage and sprinting down 3rd Avenue, never to return. Andrew Kissel had permanently relocated to his new vacation home in Vermont. Haley remained in Manhattan so their children could finish the school year. She was completely unaware of the mess her husband had left behind. Haley later said she didn't learn the truth until May 2003, after enduring months of unexplained death glares from the neighbors. Once she finally discovered what Andrew had been accused of, Haley reportedly went ballistic. For a dramatized version of what that confrontation might have sounded like, let's once again welcome John Stamos and his co-star, Gretchen Egolf.
Andrew, what have you done?
I've made us money, Haley.
Money? That's
yes.
it?
Yes, and to make money you have to gamble. And to gamble you have to take risks.
You've turned us
and
into
risks require nerves
for
and guts.
Money.
But you wouldn't know anything about that, Haley, because you have
for
no guts.
These are your family, Andrew. These are your children. You look them in the eyes and you tell them why you've done this to them.
Because I want them to be proud of me.
What?
The girls. I want them to be proud of their father.
Bravo. By October 2003, the full scope of Andrew Kissel's co-op fraud had finally come into focus. The forensic audit revealed he had begun siphoning money almost immediately after becoming treasurer in January 1996. Over the next several years, he created shell companies that billed the co-op for wildly inflated fees. He secretly opened a line of credit in the co-op's name and routinely treated it like his personal checking account. He even drained the building's reserve fund on two separate occasions. The grand total of Andrew's misappropriation? A whopping $4.7 million. All of which he agreed to pay back. On one condition, the co-op board had to sign a document releasing him from any civil liability. In other words, they'd give up their right to sue him. The agreement did not protect Andrew from criminal prosecution, but without a victim pressing charges, prosecutors were unlikely to take up the case. The board accepted, partly because it wanted to avoid the kind of public scandal that would drag down property values, but mostly because recovering the money immediately was far more valuable than spending years tangled in expensive litigation with no guarantee of collecting a dime. So Andrew Kissel was officially off the hook, but his pockets were nearly $5 million lighter. However, he quickly recouped most of those ill-gotten gains by selling his three-unit East 74th Street apartment that he most likely purchased with ill-gotten gains for an enormous profit. With a stack of cash in hand, Andrew moved his family to Greenwich, Connecticut, where he rented a massive estate for $15,000 a month. You know, modest, temporary digs until the 10,000-square-foot dream home he was building nearby was move-in ready. Andrew also relocated Hanrock Group, his real estate firm, to Connecticut and shifted its focus toward property development. Alongside his business partner, David Parisier, they enjoyed a string of early successes. And just like that, everything was back to normal. Andrew celebrated accordingly. He purchased a timeshare and a private jet and a $3 million yacht that he christened the Five Keys, which apparently wasn't a reference to cocaine, although in Andrew's case it certainly would have been fitting. According to those in the know, the name followed Andrew's convention of honoring his family. The Five Keys symbolized five Kissels, excluding Bill. Even in his 40s, Andrew still harbored a deep resentment toward his father. During this period, Andrew also invested in several local businesses in Greenwich, eager to ingratiate himself with his new community. And of course, he spared no expense renovating the Vermont vacation home, which now featured a state-of-the-art home theater installed by Prime Focus Communications. "I'll tell you what, Rob," Andrew said, recommending the company to his brother. "Those Del Priores do some good work." Also, unsurprisingly, Andrew had expanded his beloved collection of exotic cars, which now included four Ferraris, a custom Mercedes station wagon, and Kit, the talking Pontiac Trans Am from the 1980s hit TV show Knight Rider. Check it out.
"Good evening, Andrew. Your brother will die today."
Kit, what the fuck? Why does he keep saying that? Must be some kind of glitch or something. Anyway, the talking car wasn't even Andrew's most eccentric investment. That distinction belonged to an off-Broadway show called Pieces of Ass, which featured a dozen monologues performed by very attractive women who shared the burdens of what it was like to be, in their own estimation, a piece of ass. Andrew became close friends with the show's creator and producer, Brian Howie, who over time sensed that something almost sinister was driving the check writing man. That despite all the success, cars, vacation homes, whatever, Andrew Kissel was never satisfied. He never could kind of mesh the making of money with being happy, how he later recalled. It was like he was chasing something. Haley had recognized that emptiness in her husband too. She believed Andrew suffered from bipolar disorder, antisocial personality disorder, and crippling low self-esteem, all of which were exacerbated by his escalating dependence on drugs and alcohol. The obvious source of Andrew's darkness, Haley had reasoned, was his childhood. There's only so much trauma a boy can carry. But trauma never asks whether there's room for more.
The following is a paid advertisement for the Swindle Valued Listener Rewards Program.
Are you tired of hearing advertisements in Swindle like this one? Do you wish there was more Swindle content to distract you from your miserable existence? Don't settle for those other inferior podcasts with the annoying hosts who laugh at their own jokes. Become a Swindle Valued Listener today to receive easy access to new episodes and exclusive access to bonus episodes that are not available anywhere else. Completely advertisement free. It's fun for the whole family, but don't take our word for it.
Bro, so I was like listening to Swindled, right? And then the Valued Listener Rewards kicked in. I got rid of the ads and the reruns, man. Got some bonus episodes and like my third eye wide open, bro. Like, I used to be a sheeple, man, but now I'm so rewarded, dude. So valued, just... so value, like, shah. And the corporate greed just washed over me, bro.
Millions of Swindled fans have discovered the secret of becoming a valued listener. Try it in your own home today. Also, act now to receive the Valued News for Valued Listeners update show at no extra cost. That's a $5,000 value for one easy monthly payment of $4.99.
Go to valuedlistener.com to sign up using Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or Patreon. No long-term commitments, satisfaction guaranteed, foreign currency accepted, cancel anytime. Please, just give us your money.
Support for Swindled comes from Vinted. One of the downsides of working from home is that I almost never have a reason to buy new clothes anymore. Most days it's just a t-shirt, jeans, and whatever's clean. But every time I open my closet, I'm reminded of all the jackets, button-downs, and shoes I was absolutely convinced I'd wear at the time. And then never did. They're just taking up space. So, I finally started listing some of them on Vinted. If you haven't heard of it, Vinted is a second-hand app that makes it easy to sell pre-loved fashion and earn a little extra money from clothes you're no longer wearing. Listing an item is quick and simple, and once it sells, Vinted creates the prepaid shipping label for you, so you're not left trying to figure out the logistics yourself. The biggest selling point for me is that there are no seller fees, so you actually keep everything you earn. That made it a whole lot easier to justify finally clearing out the closet instead of letting perfectly good clothes sit there for another 5 years. And now, if I do decide to pick up something new, I don't feel like I'm just adding to the pile. So take a look through your closet. You might be surprised by what's been sitting there all this time. Give your clothes a second life with Vinted. Download the Vinted app for free to start selling with no seller fees so you keep everything you earn. Plus, for a limited time, enjoy free shipping in the US on Vinted. Support for Swindled comes from Gusto. One of the weirdest parts of running a podcast is realizing that making the show is actually the easy part. The hard part is everything else. Payroll, onboarding contractors, tax paperwork, benefits. None of that is why I started doing this, but it's part of running a real business. For a long time, payroll was one of those tasks I'd put off until the last possible minute because I was always worried I'd forget something or make a mistake. Gusto is an online payroll and benefits software built for small businesses. It's all in one, remote friendly, and incredibly easy to use, so you can pay, hire, onboard, and support your team from anywhere. What I appreciate most is that it automates a lot of the tedious administrative work. payroll tax filings happen automatically. Direct deposits are simple. And when I need to bring someone new on board, the paperwork is already built into the system instead of becoming another thing on my to-do list. It saves me time, and more importantly, it frees up my attention to focus on actually making the show instead of shuffling paperwork. If you run a small business, you'll wonder why you didn't make the switch sooner. Try Gusto today at gusto.com/swindled and get 3 months free when you run your first payroll. That's 3 months of free payroll at gusto.com/swindled. One more time, gusto.com/swindled.
Just 2 hours after finding the body of millionaire banker Robert Kissel, his wife Nancy has been charged with bludgeoning him to death. Police are releasing few details about the murder, but do say Nancy Kissel has been taken into custody.
After Robert Kissel's body was discovered in the basement of Parkview on November 6, 2003, and Nancy was taken into custody, both sides of the family rushed to Hong Kong. Rob's father Bill, his sister Jane, and his older brother Andrew all made the trip in varying states of shock. Beyond the murder investigation itself, the most important issue at hand was determining who would take care of Rob and Nancy's three young children and the potential $20 million estate that came with them. Following a lengthy and at times heated meeting of the families, everyone reluctantly agreed that Nancy's father, Ira Keeshan, would take the kids back to his home in Winnetka, Illinois, near Chicago. Rob had always been close to Ira, had named him guardian and co-executor in his most recent will, and, on paper at least, it appeared to be exactly what he would have wanted. But within days, it became clear that that arrangement wasn't going to work. Ira Keeshan's wife, who had been opposed to the idea from the start, felt she and her husband were ill-equipped to properly care for a 9, 7, and 4-year-old. She was quickly proven correct. Without consulting the Kissels, Ira transferred custody of the children to his son Brooks, Nancy's 24-year-old half-brother, a medical student in Cincinnati. When Bill Kissel learned of this latest development, he became enraged. Although Bill had no intention of raising the children himself, he considered Brooks wholly unqualified. The elder Kissel demanded another family meeting, where he accused the young man of only wanting custody of Rob's kids so that he could molest them. Bill threatened to spread the accusation publicly and ruin Brooks' life if he refused to hand them over. Andrew and Haley Kissel emerged as the obvious next in line. They were financially secure, had two little ones of their own, appeared to have a stable marriage, and genuinely wanted to take Rob's children into their home for 20 million different reasons. Within days, Andrew chartered a private jet to Cincinnati to bring his nieces and nephew back to Greenwich. That flight, and roughly $170,000 in additional expenses, was billed to Rob's estate almost immediately. Emboldened by his new safety net, courtesy of his dead brother, Andrew's spending became even more compulsive and substantial. When he got tired of waiting for a table at one of his favorite restaurants, he would purchase a controlling interest. When one of his daughters developed an interest in horseback riding, he bought the entire stable. Andrew was drinking more than ever, so he bought a liquor store, and so on. Haley Kissel's concern over Andrew's behavior increased by the day, and all the money stuff was just part of the problem. Inside the house, their marriage was falling apart. In the summer of 2004, Haley began confiding in Andrew's sister Jane, her longtime friend and former ski student. Andrew was having an affair, Haley told her, and she planned to leave him soon. I'm busting my ass taking care of 5 kids, while he's off having dinner with her in nice restaurants. I can't believe I've stayed in the relationship this long, but this is the ultimate humiliation, and I can't take it. Plus, she was pretty sure Andrew was running some kind of Ponzi scheme. Haley claimed she tried to ask him about it once, and he replied, quote, "It's none of your fucking business. I don't tell you how to analyze stocks." Good talk. Haley tried to tough it out for a little while longer, but another breaking point came in May 2005. Andrew spent the weekend aboard his newest and even larger yacht off the coast of Florida. He had named this one Special K's, which, as tradition dictated, was another nod to his family, though this one was considerably less specific, for obvious homicidal reasons. Among those on board were Brian Howie, several young actresses from his off-Broadway production, and a woman named Allison Statler, the public relations consultant widely rumored to be Andrew's mistress. The party ended prematurely when Haley called Andrew's cell phone and a drunken woman answered. Even the guests on the upper deck could hear the screams that blasted through the earpiece. A few days later, Brian Howie says, Andrew was checking into rehab. Haley's anger had boiled over. God, I hate your brother, she wrote in the first of a series of emails to Jane a few days later. He is just such an awful, awful, pathetic person. I just fucking hate him. His I am the king attitude, his value system or lack thereof, his anger, his meanness. I just hate him, Haley continued, switching to all caps. He will never be a good, responsible person. He is horrible, just horrible, and I hate his fucking guts. Do you know, last night in bed, I could actually see myself pummeling him to death and just enjoying the sensation of each and every shot. And then this morning, as I pulled out of the garage to go to spin class, all I wanted to do was crash into his Ferraris. I hate him. Coincidentally, while Haley Kissel was furiously hammering away on her keyboard in Greenwich, elsewhere in Connecticut, another woman was outlining an entirely different set of grievances about the very same man. Her complaints centered on Andrew Kissel's real estate business. All at once, the carefully maintained facade Andrew had built around both his personal and professional life was beginning to crumble.
Well, I was involved in two real estate transactions with Mr. Kissel through his attorney, and the fact that there were two back-to-back transactions, each with some unusual circumstances, mm-hmm. led us to be a little suspicious and caused us to scrutinize some of the documents that were being involved with these various properties he was developing, and ultimately led us to conclude that something was not right.
In May 2005, Nancy Walkley, an in-house attorney for Fidelity National Title in Trumbull, Connecticut, was performing one of the most routine parts of her job, reviewing the paperwork for a construction loan issued by Fairfield County Bank, secured by a property in Greenwich. The title agent who handed her the file told her it would be an easy one. The lot was a teardown for an established builder who had a solid reputation and an even stronger net worth. Last name, Kissel. A consummate professional, Nancy Walkley performed her customary due diligence and quickly spotted a glaring oversight. The Greenwich property had already been pledged as collateral for a different mortgage issued by a Brooklyn bank just days earlier, a lien that had never been disclosed during the application for the new loan. This was a major issue, but perhaps there was a reasonable explanation. Actually, there is, the applicant's attorney replied to Walkley's concerns. Looks like the Brooklyn Bank recorded its mortgage against the wrong property. My client, Andrew, owned several properties in Greenwich, and many of them are financed by the same bank. Mistakes happen. We'll have the bank issue a release, get it notarized, and fax it over first thing Monday, the attorney assured. Just as promised, the release was waiting for Nancy Walkley when she returned to work after the weekend. Satisfied, she cleared the title, scheduled the closing for early June, and moved on to her next file. 2 weeks later, it happened again. Different property, different lender, same applicant. This time, Andrew Kissel was applying for a $6.4 million mortgage from a California bank on an apartment complex he owned in Woodbury. But Walkley's title search turned up the same issue. The property was already encumbered by an undisclosed $5.4 million mortgage from a bank in Astoria. Once again, Andrew's attorney insisted it was all a misunderstanding. Once again, a notarized release arrived, and once again, the title company scheduled a closing. There was just one last hurdle. Unfortunately, Mr. Kissel will be out of the country on that date, but we will send over a power of attorney so the closing can proceed without him. When that power of attorney document arrived, Nancy Walkley took one look at Andrew Kissel's signature and nearly fainted.
The color must have drained out of my face. I thought, oh my, I can't believe what I think is happening is happening.
Look at the A in Andrew, Walkley instructed, sliding the power of attorney document across the desk to a colleague. See those large, sweeping loops? It's pretty distinctive, right? Now look at this, she said, as she handed over the release from Astoria Federal that had arrived a few days earlier. Look at the bank officer's signature. The first name was Arthur. It began with an identical, oversized looping A. Everyone at Fidelity National Title agreed. The similarity was indisputable. But to confirm her suspicions, Walkley called Astoria Federal. She was told there was no clerical error, no release had ever been issued, and the $5.4 million mortgage was indeed legitimate. Realizing this one instance was probably just the tip of the iceberg, Nancy Walkley and her colleagues began combing through every property connected to Andrew Kissel. She almost fainted again. Nearly all of them carried multiple mortgages, some as many as three. In many cases, the total borrowed against a single property exceeded its value by millions of dollars. Yet every loan was still active, every payment was current, and every transaction had been supported by forged documents notarized by the same person, a former Hanrock employee who had quit years earlier and had inadvertently left her notary stamp behind. It was a bombshell discovery, and the FBI saw it the same way. On July 26, 2005, Andrew Kissel was charged with bank fraud. Prosecutors alleged he had illegally obtained as much as $34 million from at least four different banks, and come to find out, that wasn't the only financial deception he had been hiding. Years earlier, without telling his investors, Andrew had quietly sold the New Jersey real estate portfolio Hanrock had purchased with their money for approximately $25 million. Roughly $15 million of those proceeds should have been returned to the investors, many of whom Andrew counted among his closest friends and family. Instead, he used those funds to finance Hanrock's expansion into Connecticut, all while continuing to mail quarterly distribution checks for years to reassure investors that their original investments were still intact. Andrew took money from everybody possible, his father Bill told the New York Times. From his father-in-law, from friends, from Robert, from everybody, and they're all holding the bag. His wife Haley was among them. Without her knowledge, Andrew had forged documents transferring ownership of their Vermont home from her name into his own. Yet even with the divorce pending, and after discovering he had secretly stolen from her, she still posted his bail. He's a sick man, Judge, Andrew's attorney Philip Russell confirmed at his arraignment. He promised his client would seek psychiatric treatment and intended to plead guilty. But his legal troubles didn't end there. In September 2005, a Manhattan grand jury resurrected Andrew's past by indicting him on first-degree grand larceny and other charges stemming from his 2003 scheme to embezzle money from the East 74th Street Co-op, where he had served as treasurer. Combined with the federal bank fraud case, Andrew now faced up to 45 years in prison and tens of millions of dollars in fines.
Andrew Kissel, once a successful real estate developer, drove flashy cars and lived in this gated estate. But the high life hit a low point. His lawyer says he fell into drugs and he was charged with more than $25 million in fraud, including millions stolen from the owners of this New York apartment building where he served on the board.
Additionally, multiple lawsuits had been filed against Andrew Kissel, two by title companies, another by his Hanrock business partner, several more by investors who claimed he had defrauded them, and finally, his own wife. Haley Kissel officially filed for divorce and asked the court to force Andrew out of their Greenwich mansion. The family was already facing eviction after Andrew had failed to pay their rent for months. The financial collapse spilled into another corner of the Kissel family tragedy. Believing Andrew's mounting legal troubles and pending divorce made his household unstable, Andrew's sister Jane pushed for custody of Rob's three children. In court filings, she alleged that Haley had admitted the family was in dire financial straits and intended to fight for custody because of the children's substantial inheritance, regardless of whether it was in their best interest. The renewed custody dispute drew interest from the media. On September 24, 2005, The New York Times published an article titled, "For Three Little Millionaires, A Series of Painful Events." Jane accused Haley of viewing the children as a financial lifeline. Bill Kissel had once referred to Haley as a, quote, money-grubbing bitch, supported his daughter's position. Andrew is in deep trouble, he told the paper. It wouldn't be appropriate to have the children in the house without a mother and a father, where the wife needs the children to support her lifestyle. Andrew and Haley both took exception.
James, your ex-brother, you're famous. You're the front page of the New York Times. You should get it, as you quoted. And we are going to bury you, James.
With their backs against the wall, the imploding couple found support from an unlikely source. Writing from a Hong Kong prison, Nancy Kissel said she had been overwhelmed by Haley's unwavering loyalty. Children understand love, she wrote. They don't understand change. Loving families don't turn on each other. They support one another. The judge appreciated the irony, but sided with common sense. On December 13, 2005, he awarded custody of Rob's three children to Jane Kissel Clayton. A week later, the siblings were flown from Greenwich to Seattle to begin a new life with their aunt. At that point, 46-year-old Andrew Kissel had officially hit rock bottom. His marriage was over, his children were gone, his brother's children and their inheritance were gone. The bones of his own fortune and business were being picked clean in court, and he was on house arrest while being evicted. All Andrew could do now was sit and wait for judgment day. Until then, might as well live like someone with nothing left to lose. With no one left by his side, Andrew Kissel grew closer to the one person who had never abandoned him, his driver and all-purpose gopher, Carlos Trujillo. Carlos, a 38-year-old Colombian immigrant, had worked for Andrew for more than 5 years. His loyalty ran deep because Andrew had given him opportunities no one else had. When they first met, Andrew even paid for Carlos to take English classes at a local community college before giving him a job. The two trusted each other completely. Carlos picked up Andrew's children from school, cleaned his cars, ran his errands. When the co-op scandal erupted in New York, Carlos even stayed behind to intercept Andrew's mail and keep Haley in the dark. Now, his responsibilities had changed. Carlos's main duty was helping Andrew liquidate whatever valuables remained, selling watches, artwork, and other possessions to keep cash flowing for the only things Andrew still seemed to care about: lawyers, prostitutes, and cocaine. The two men would sit for hours in the cavernous, nearly empty house, talking. Andrew admitted he couldn't fully explain why he had done any of it. He had betrayed his investors, his family, his friends, everyone he had ever cared about. And for what? Just the rush, he guessed. Prison, he told Carlos, no longer seemed like the end of the world. It was simply the next chapter. His attorney had already prepared him for the most likely outcome, about 8 years behind bars, if he pleaded guilty to everything. Andrew had resigned himself to it. He deserved it. Only a few days remained before sentencing, he sighed. Make sure you pay me a visit, he told Carlos, before saying goodbye. On Sunday, April 2, 2006, Haley arrived with moving trucks to collect the last of their belongings and relocate them to the new house her father had purchased for her and the children. Andrew pleaded with her to at least leave him a bed. Please, I have nowhere else to go. Haley relented and rolled her eyes. Fine. Can you guys come back tomorrow to pick it up? She asked the movers. He's going to jail anyway. No problem, ma'am. The truck returned at 8:30 the following morning. The security gate was closed. They buzzed repeatedly, but received no answer. After calling their dispatcher, who contacted Haley, they were given the code. Once they gained access, the movers knocked on the front door and rang the bell before trying the handle. It was unlocked. One of the movers eased the door open and called into the house. Hello? Anybody here? No response. The men exchanged a glance, shrugged, and stepped inside. One headed upstairs to dismantle the bedroom furniture. Another walked toward the basement to retrieve a wine refrigerator Haley had forgotten. He flipped on the light and gasped. There, slumped forward in a chair in the middle of the floor, was Andrew Kissel, his hands bound behind his back, mouth gagged, t-shirt pulled over his head, surrounded by a pool of blood.
body of Andrew Michael Kissel, who was found dead within his residence at 10 Dairy Road.
The preliminary findings of the autopsy indicate that Mr. Kissel's death was the result of multiple stab wounds.
There was no robbery, there was no burglary, there was no forced entry to the residence. The manner and the way in which this was carried out gives us a level of comfort in stating that it was Mr. Kissel that was the intended victim.
Support for Swindled comes from Mood. I think a lot of people still assume that if you want cannabis products, you have to drive somewhere, wait in line, and hope the person behind the counter knows what they're talking about. But what a lot of people don't realize is hemp-derived cannabis products, things like THC gummies, edibles, pre-rolls, flower, and more, are still completely legal to buy online, and Mood makes it incredibly easy. Everything ships discreetly, straight to your door. What I like about Mood is that they don't just have one product for everybody. You can shop based on the kind of experience you're looking for, whether that's something to help you unwind at the end of the day, stay focused while you're working, feel a little more upbeat, or even spice up date night. Personally, I've been a fan of their Mind Magic gummies when I have a long day of riding ahead of me. They fit those marathon research sessions surprisingly well. They've also got flower, pre-rolls, edibles, and plenty of other options, all sourced from small, pesticide-free, family-run farms here in the United States. If you've been curious, there's an easy way to check it out. Head to mood.com and use promo code SWINDLED to get 20% off your first purchase. That's mood.com, promo code SWINDLED.
Murder in the mansion. A real estate mogul found stabbed to death in his basement in the ritzy New York City suburb of Greenwich, Connecticut. Andrew Kissel is his name. He was facing a bunch of criminal charges and going through a messy divorce. In fact, he and his wife were moving out the day his body was found. And oh, by the way, his brother was also murdered a few years ago in Hong Kong.
A case called the Milkshake Murder. Robert Kissel's wife convicted of drugging his milkshake with sedatives and then beating him to death. Andrew Kissel's killing now the talk of the town in this quiet community not known for notorious crime.
Two brothers, now side by side. One had been rich and successful. One had been rich and disgraced. Yet both suffered the same terrible fate.
According to the Greenwich Police Department, the crime scene was remarkably clean. Even so, detectives spent 2 days combing through the house and even drained the swimming pool, collecting more than 300 pieces of evidence. None of it brought them any closer to identifying the killer, not even the blood-stained tissues scattered throughout the home, which investigators eventually traced to nosebleeds caused by Andrew Kissel's cocaine habit. No fingerprints, no DNA, no murder weapon. But one thing the scene did point to was that it was a targeted attack, probably from someone Andrew knew, the police said. The method of murder was extremely personal. There were no signs of forced entry. What little valuables Andrew had left remained untouched. The only thing missing was his cell phone.
He was found in the basement of his gated estate in Greenwich, Connecticut. Hands and feet bound, stabbed in the chest. No sign of forced entry. Police believe millionaire Andrew Kissel was killed by someone he knew. But whom and why?
Who would want to kill Andrew Kissel? Well, how much time you got, buddy? Even Andrew's own father admitted the list of suspects was practically endless. It could have been a betrayed business partner, or one of the many investors he'd stolen from. Perhaps it was a small-time contractor, tired of chasing payment, or a drug deal gone wrong. Maybe a sex worker had been stiffed, and her angry pimp came to collect on the unpaid tab. Could have been a jilted mistress, or her furious husband. Or maybe
it was his wife, who'd moved out not long after writing an email, fantasizing about pummeling her husband to death and enjoying the sensation of each and every shot.
Naturally, the police's initial focus was on the people closest to Andrew. At the top of that list was Haley Kissel. The angry and violent emails she had sent to her dead husband's sister didn't help her case. Neither did the fact that she made a $10 million claim on Andrew's life insurance within days of his death. Bill Kissel certainly wouldn't rule out the possibility of her involvement. She's driven by money, he told New York Magazine. She's not a nice person. Haley cooperated fully with investigators and was ultimately eliminated as a suspect after providing an airtight alibi. As for the allusions to violence in her emails, her attorney dismissed it as nothing more than a clear venting of frustration and anger over Andrew's behavior at that time.
Nobody's gonna send emails to the sister if they had any serious thoughts of doing something that would be the dumbest thing you could do.
Next, Greenwich PD's attention turned to Carlos Trujillo, Andrew's right-hand man, and the last person to see Andrew alive. Carlos was interviewed on multiple occasions without a lawyer present. He emphatically denied any involvement in the murder, but said that not even Andrew would have been surprised about what happened to him.
He told me a lot of people hate me. He told me many times, you know, a lot of people, you know, want to kill him.
Detectives believed Carlos knew way more than he was telling them. They pointed to inconsistencies in his timeline and accused him of withholding the extent of his family's role in Andrew Kissel's business affairs. Carlos soon found himself at the center of the investigation. Police searched his home, swabbed his DNA, pressured his relatives, and administered a polygraph examination that he reportedly failed. But Carlos never wavered from his story.
We are the best friend, you know, and he treated me like his son. I love him like my father, you know. I can't believe that's, you know, I had the possibility to kill him.
Even Bill Kissel thought the focus on Carlos was misguided. Carlos was a close friend of Andrew's, he told the New York Times. Why would he do it? What would be the motive? And why in such an angry and bloodthirsty way? Detectives couldn't answer those questions either, and with no evidence tying him to the murder, they begrudgingly let Carlos Trujillo walk free. By then, alternative theories were beginning to swirl. Maybe Andrew Kissel hadn't been murdered by an enraged victim or a disgruntled associate at all. Maybe the killing had been commissioned by the victim himself. Think about it. Andrew was staring down the prospect of spending years, perhaps even decades, in prison. His assets were divvied up by everyone he had wronged. By the time Andrew regained his freedom, there would be nothing left for him or his children. The only substantial asset still standing was a $10 million life insurance policy.
Was it suicide by hitman? A new theory about the real estate mogul who was about to go up the river, but ended up butchered in his own basement. The New York Post newspaper, which is owned by the parent company of this network, is reporting that Andrew Kissel may have ordered his own murder, hiring a hitman to rub him out so his kids could get at least a $10 million life insurance payoff.
His father, Bill Kissel, wouldn't put it past him, telling the New York Times, quote, "It's the most incredibly unselfish thing that anybody could do." But that's just one of the reasons the theory was discounted by so many. Even Andrew's own attorney said he couldn't imagine his client being selfless enough to sacrifice his life for someone else's benefit. Others pointed to the brutal manner of death as a reason to doubt it. Who would pick being stabbed multiple times and bleeding out off the menu of demise? 2 years passed, and to the outside world, the investigation seemed to have gone nowhere. Critics claimed the Greenwich Police Department had botched yet another high-profile homicide, as many believed it had in the 1975 murder of Martha Moxley, a case that took nearly 25 years to produce an arrest. Bill Kissel had resigned himself to the idea that he would probably die before seeing justice for his son. But what no one outside the investigation knew was that detectives had quietly uncovered a promising lead. And in early 2008, it paid off. The Andrew Kissel murder case was finally closed.
Arrests tonight in the sensational murder of a Connecticut millionaire. Two cousins charged in the case, one of them the victim's chauffeur. Andrew Kissel, found tied and stabbed to death in 2006, just days before he was set to plead guilty in a multi-million dollar fraud case.
On March 23, 2008, Greenwich police arrested 49-year-old Carlos Trujillo and his 21-year-old cousin, Leonard Lenny Trujillo, charging both men with capital murder. It had been a long time coming, the police said. They had identified Carlos early on in the process, obviously, but could never quite pin him down. What broke the case open, they said, was a search of Carlos's house in April 2006. Among the items seized was a credit card belonging to a woman the detectives didn't recognize. Just to cover their bases, police tracked that woman down and asked if she knew anything about a homicide. She replied, quote, "You mean they killed that rich Jew guy?" "Who's they?" an investigator replied. "That guy Carlos," the woman said. "He offered my half-brother Lenny a bunch of money to kill his boss." Why Carlos Trujillo would want to kill Andrew Kissel was something that investigators had been slowly piecing together. Prosecutors alleged that Carlos, along with his girlfriend and brother, had been helping Andrew secretly liquidate valuables, launder cash, and conceal assets from federal authorities. But most of the cash, an estimated $230,000, never made it back to Andrew, who, needless to say, wasn't happy about it. Investigators believe the Trujillos feared Andrew would exact revenge by exposing their role in his financial schemes. Rather than risk it, Carlos allegedly decided to eliminate that possibility. He recruited his cousin Lenny, offering him $10,000 and a laptop to help carry out the murder. When the cops tracked down Lenny Trujillo in Worcester, Massachusetts, where he lived, he confessed to everything. He said the plan had been in the works for 6 to 8 months. He described numerous conversations with Carlos, scouting trips to Connecticut, and purchases made in preparation for the killing. Detectives corroborated much of his account with receipts, phone records, and surveillance footage. There was just one problem. Lenny insisted he wasn't actually there when Andrew was killed. He said his plan all along was to take Carlos's money and disappear. And he claimed that's exactly what he did. Even so, Leonard Trujillo ultimately pleaded guilty to reduced charges of manslaughter and conspiracy to commit murder. He was sentenced to 20 years in prison. When Carlos Trujillo went to trial in December 2010, the state's case rested entirely on the testimony of his cousin and a web of circumstantial evidence.
What reason would police have to get someone to make a false confession?
Well, the reason would be to close out a case. They had a theory from minute one. Their theory was Carlos did it, and it seemed like they've been doing all they can to make that theory fit.
The defense spent much of the trial dismantling Lenny's credibility, arguing that his story changed whenever investigators uncovered new evidence. Carlos's attorney, Lindy Urso, argued that Greenwich police had fixated on his client almost from the beginning, then spent the next 2 years bending the evidence to support that conclusion instead of seriously investigating other suspects with far stronger motives. In Urso's view, the real killer had never been identified. In the end, the jury acquitted Carlos Trujillo of murder, but deadlocked on an attempted murder charge, resulting in a mistrial. Before a second trial could begin, however, Carlos entered an Alford plea, which allowed him to maintain his innocence while acknowledging that the prosecution had enough evidence to likely secure a conviction. He was sentenced to 20 years in prison, suspended after 6, with credit for roughly 3 years he had already served. Around 2014, Carlos was released from prison and immediately deported to Colombia. But while Carlos Trujillo chose to avoid another trial, someone else in the Kissel saga was eagerly awaiting a second chance at theirs.
In her first trial, Nancy's lawyers had argued that she'd killed Rob in self-defense. This time around, they claimed something called diminished responsibility. Through psychiatric experts, they tried to show that Nancy was a battered woman. The argument was she was in the throes of a major depression the night she killed her husband.
After years of appeals, Nancy Kissel finally won a legal victory in February 2010 when Hong Kong's highest court overturned her murder conviction. The justices ruled that prosecutors had improperly introduced prejudicial hearsay evidence and that the trial judge had misdirected the jury on several key legal issues. The decision earned Nancy a new trial, where she once again claimed she had acted in self-defense against her abusive, violent, drug-addicted husband. But the outcome was ultimately the same. In March 2011, a unanimous jury found her guilty of murder for a second time, and she was once again sentenced to life in a Hong Kong prison, where she remains to this day. Nancy Kissel has continued to appeal her sentence, even as recently as 2020.
Kissel's father, Ira Keeshan, who has attended all her court appearances, and half-brother Brooks Keeshan were not optimistic as they left court.
Well, hopefully she'll hold up.
So,
She's been in prison a long time.
Nancy has always had a hard time letting go. Just Ask Michael Del Priore. After her arrest, she wrote him nearly every day for close to a year. The letters, sometimes 5 pages long, were filled with detailed fantasies and delusions about the couple's future together. Michael never responded. Instead, he and his new wife would read the letters, shake their heads, and throw them in a box, which was locked away in a storage room forever. Some things are better left in the dark, so they're easily forgotten. Especially Nancy Kissel. Swindled is written, researched, produced, and hosted by me, a concerned citizen, with original music by Trevor Howard, aka The Former, aka The Stereo Boy. For more information about Swindled, you can visit swindledpodcast.com and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok at Swindled Podcast, or you can send us a postcard at P.O. Box 2045, Austin, Texas 78768. But please, no packages. We do not trust you. Swindled is a completely independent production, which means no network, no investors, no bosses, no shadowy money men, no milkshakes. And we plan to keep it that way, but we need your support. Become a valued listener on Patreon, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify at valuedlistener.com. For as little as $5 a month, you will receive early access to new episodes and exclusive access to bonus episodes that you can't find anywhere else. And everything is 100% commercial free. Become a valued listener at valuedlistener.com. Or if you want to support the show and need something to wear during your next custody battle, consider buying something you don't need at swindledpodcast.com/shop. There are t-shirts, patches, hats, hoodies, posters, coffee mugs, and more. swindledpodcast.com/shop. And remember to use coupon code CAPITALISM to receive 10% off your order. If you don't want anything in return for your support, you can always simply donate using the form on the homepage. That's it. Thanks for listening.
Hello, my name is Ben from Walnut Creek.
Hello, my name is Philip from Billings, Montana.
Hello, my name is Charlene from Richmond, Virginia, and I'm a concerned citizen and a valued listener.
And I'm really concerned.
For only $5 a month, you too can join our club.